Another episode of The Connected Show. We are hanging out today with my boy, Todd Rafael Cimino, and he is an author, a screenwriter, story editor, all kinds of good stuff, man. He's got a lot of stuff going on, a couple films that he's working on, some books, and he's going to talk about his relationship with George Jung and his relationship with Scarlett Johansson, a good friend of his that helped him out in the entertainment industry. And this is going to be cool, man. It's going to be a great show. And before we begin the show, I just want everybody to go tune in, check out thesdlawfirm.com. Today's episode is brought to you by a good friend of mine over at AM Law Group, my boy Anthony Medina. He has a law firm here in San Diego. He's from San Diego, and he's got a heart for the community. He loves to help people out, and he's born and raised here in San Diego as well as educated here in San Diego, and he's dedicated to serving the community, and he's helped me out with my nonprofit and the stuff I got going on. So make sure you check him out, thesdlawfirm.com, AM Law Group, my boy Anthony Medina, always helping people out in the community. Check him out, and you know, you never know when you're going to need an attorney, so reach out. Hit up my boy, doing good things. And here we go with, you know, Todd Rafael Cimino. Let's get connected. Get connected. Yo, if you're C-O-N-E-C-T-A-D-O, you already know about the show, so let's go. It's your music and lifestyle, fashion profile, the entertainment source for everything you want to know about. North to the south, the east to the west side, stay connected with Ruben Torres worldwide, so let's go. Across the globe, well respected, beasting on the industry. Connected. Welcome to The Connected Show. Today we are sitting here chilling today, talking to our friend Todd Rafael Cimino, and he's out in the East Coast, and it's a pleasure to have him. He's an all-around author, screenwriter, story editor, everything. He's been in the entertainment industry for a long time, so thanks for coming on, Todd.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ruben.
So, man, just I know you've been extremely busy. You're out on the East Coast working on a couple projects. And is there anything current that you could kind of touch on with some of the stuff that you got going on?
Yeah, we're actually have five films on my palette, and wow. All are moving forward at a great pace. We have Heavy, which is based on the book I wrote with George Jung. George Jung is person that was portrayed by Johnny Depp in the film Blood, Heavy is a great project. It's we're just working on locations right now, having some issues with Puerto Rico and trying to take it to possibly Cuba, which could be very interesting.
Nice.
So Lesser Endeavors, pick. And we have a development deal with HBO on that. That's moving forward at a great pace. Scott Rudin attached, executive producer, showrunner Scott Rudin. So things are moving at a great pace. We're blessed. 2016 is going to be a very, very busy year. That I can promise.
Well, tell me a little bit about the book Heavy. You're also turning into a film, so and this is all coming from the George Jung relationship, correct?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, Heavy is whereas Blow was a larger, big picture biopic of George Jung. Heavy deals with 3 months, three very intense months. That start with George breaking out of Cuban prison with two of his cellmates, and then another helper joins them, and they flee the island of Cuba, get caught in a storm, and end up in Guatemala. The rest of the story is basically them trying to get back home, and the things that desperate people do when they're between a rock and a hard place. And then in their scenario, they're being chased by federal agents, American federal agents, Guatemalan police, the Colombian cartels. They're basically being chased by everyone, and the things they have to do to escape are pretty miraculous, and it's all based on real facts. And it's a pretty involved story. It takes place in the spring of 1980. You know, when we had 52 hostages sitting in Iranian diplomatic housing unit as hostages. So, you know, that's that was a very, very transitional time for a lot of Americans. It was an election year. That was the year we elected Ronald Reagan. So, you know, a lot of change, a lot of political strife.
But what exactly is your relationship with George, and how does a relationship like that begin?
I met George in 1984. I was working on a TV show, Miami Vice. I was a Marine coordinator, and he was a pretty vocal guy, a pretty visible guy in the Miami area, Miami Beach area, a couple of places that I would hang out at. One was called Turnberry. The other was called the Jockey Club, and George would bounce back and forth depending on where he had been kicked out of previously. He had a fishing boat he wanted to have. He wanted to have that boat in Miami Vice. It never happened. But yeah, that's how we kind of struck up a friendship, and that kind of has lasted. When George was released in June of 2014, he was released to me in Philadelphia. I've tried to help him. We manage everything. We manage his finances. We manage, his speaking engagements, you name it. He's living on the West Coast. He's in Sacramento, so it has its challenges. But he's doing well, and he's enjoying life again. And he should. A lot of people don't understand that. The movie Blow depicted him going to prison for cocaine, but he really didn't. The real story is, he went to prison for being in the same house where there was marijuana. Albeit 300 pounds of marijuana, but he was in the house. He wasn't buying it. He wasn't dealing it. He wasn't smuggling it. It was somebody else's deal. He was at the wrong place at the wrong time, and they put him away for 20 years because of that.
Wow.
So you look at the marijuana culture today, and it's a completely different landscape. We're looking at legalizing marijuana in some states, and, hemp and many others, to think this guy did 20 years for marijuana is kind of a sad scenario, but it is what it is.
And what did you catch any kind of flack or any kind of negative, you have some background in involved in customs and all that stuff. Was there any kind of negative flack that you caught from your involvement with George?
Not at all. There's a lot of realistic interplay between both sides, and that's normal with law enforcement. It's normal with street cops. I mean, street cops are usually pretty friendly with gang members and some of the other characters that they have to deal with on a daily basis. It helps promote their sanity. You can't be a human and treat everyone like an asshole, if you will. You've got to exercise some humanity. And with George, it was the same way. Had George been in an aircraft and I was tasked to target that aircraft, that'd be a different scenario. That never occurred. So we were never in the same airspace. We were never in the same situation investigation. Keep in mind that predominantly most of my activities took place in the 90s, and George was already out of the game by then. So most of this stuff taking place in the 70s and 80s.
Is there anything else that we can expect from George that's going to be coming out soon besides the book here?
Yeah, I think George is George and I have actually talked about a Fidel Castro project. George has met Fidel Castro numerous times. They had a working relationship. That's something that that's on the burner right now. Once we get through this year and maybe next year, something we could probably ignite right around 2018, I would think.
Great.
Country that you're working in, territory, whatever you want to call it, literally goes bankrupt, then you have to kind of backpedal a little bit. So locations are an issue right now. The storyline takes place in Cuba and Guatemala. Cuba would be awesome if this works out. It'll be one of the first major, if not the first major American film to be shot in Cuba.
Wow. Yeah, and that's a big deal because they're not really letting much happen.
It is a big deal.
Yeah.
That's a huge deal.
Yeah, they're not letting anything happen.
And the fact that this was written for Cuba, I should say the opening scenes are written in Cuba. It's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and tell me, so you've written four books as of now, right? Or is it four or five books?
No, actually I'm on number four right now. That's coming out in June, and that's Battle of Angels. And set to be released the end of June.
Now, and as an author, how did you get your start as an author?
Oh, I started writing in 92. I was working as a special agent with U.S. Customs Service, and in off hours would write about the experiences that, the things I was seeing, the experiences I was, going through in South Florida. Pretty much the height of the drug war in South Florida. And, bit by bit, it accumulated. I never really took it seriously. In 2008, I decided to go ahead and start compiling everything and putting it into a draft form. By November 2009, it was released. And Mid-Ocean today is my best-selling book. Appeared in sold in 31 different countries. 1.2 million copies sold. It's not my favorite story. I wish I could write overwrite, or I should say rewrite portions. But it was my first, so we evolve, we get better, it is what it is. It's a great story. It's just my writing has developed to a point now where I feel much more confident. I think it's a better product. Battle of Angels is going to be an amazing work, and I'm not just saying that because I wrote it, but I think the storyline is great. I think it's a project that people will hopefully embrace. It's a great story, and it's not just male oriented or female oriented. It's it captures the full gamut, young, old, you name it.
And I see that some of your writing has a lot of maybe some like gangster influence in there somewhere. Some of the reviews and stuff.
Yeah, well, it has more federal agent influence, and because of that, there is the interface with organized crime. In Table 21, it was the New York mob. In Mid-Ocean, it was the South Florida drug cartels. In Heavy, it was the Colombian cartels, Pablo Escobar and Carlos Lader. Battle of Angels deals with the Ku Klux Klan and small town America. And the influence that the Ku Klux Klan still has in America today, in the year 2016, we still have radical, ultra conservative domestic terrorists living among us here in America. and they're not Muslim. They're not from the Middle East. They're born and bred right here in the United States. They're purists. They're white, and they believe that their race is supreme. And these are a true threat to America and Americans alike. So that's Battle of Angels coming out in June.
Wow, and so you have publishers for this, or are you doing this self-published?
Of course, we go through BMG. Yeah.
Now, how has releasing a book changed throughout the years?
Wow, that's a great question. When I was first approached with the idea of going digital, my first concern was security, and how does my book not end up, on everybody's iPad, or iPod, the music that people are stealing on a regular basis. And at that point in time, it was a small market. We started, of course, with Midocean, and I think we were selling 10 printed copies for every digital copy. Probably about 6 months in, that reversed, and now it's to the point where we're literally selling hundreds of digital copies for a printed copy. Because of this, your publishers are not publishers anymore. They're not manufacturing a printed product. They're selling a digital product. And so that entire paradigm has changed. In some respects, it's easier. In some respects, it's harder because the market has been flooded with a lot of work that doesn't necessarily warrant, publishing. There's a lot of stuff out there, lack of a better word, junk, and it is what it is. And so it has definitely muddied the waters. But listen, your critics, they're still able to receive the material, whether it be digital or printed. And, a lot of that is just that paradigm has stayed the same. And through the different digital mediums, we can access a larger audience internationally. It makes it a lot easier.
Is that a blessing and a curse at the same time? To release?
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword, it's like the internet. I have huge disdain for the internet, but, I can't help to deny or help but accept the fact that, it's definitely benefited me in many ways. And like I was saying, books are heavy, and if you've got to ship, a dozen cases of books to China, the price of your book, goes up exponentially with the freight cost. So, unless you're actually big enough to be printing in other countries like China, which, most publishers are not, that limits the accessibility that the rest of the world has for your printed work. So, we enter the digital age, and now we're able to, in a matter of seconds, someone in China or someone in Japan or someone in the UK or Bulgaria can speak English, read English, they can pick up your product. I think we're at about 22% of our book sales are international. So, that's a good thing. And we actually get a little bit more money that way, because of the strength of the dollar. So, at the end of the month, the residuals look a little stronger.
Is there a certain strategy or release technique that they would use? When you put out an album, you put out the single, and then there's, all the promotion that you do before. Is there a strategy that some of these publishers use?
Yeah, listen, there's a lot of strategies out there, and I'll be the first one to admit that I don't usually partake in them. There's a lot of talk about what the presidential candidate Ted Cruz did to get his book out. There's a strategy where you literally buy 100,000 copies of your own book, in the first couple of days, and you get the numbers up. Well, once the numbers are up, then, platforms like KDP, which is Amazon, you know, Kindle, digital platform. They're now promoting your book because they see it as a marketable item. You know, Barnes & Noble, Pubit does the same thing. You know, Smashwords, all of these digital platforms respond to the surge in sales when, in fact, they're not real sales. The guy's just buying his own book, and, you know, he's willing to fork over the, you know, the 20 or 25% commission that they have to pay to the facilitator, you know, because he's getting that money back. In the end, you know, he's getting his book out there. He's now a bestseller, and he's getting a lot of attention, when in fact it was him who bought the book in the first place. So, you know, that's a strategy that, you know, we're seeing quite a bit. It's a, you know, it's a manipulation of the market. And of course, I would never participate in, you know, anything like that. That's just, listen, you know, one of the first things we do before we release a book, you know, 30 to 60 days out, we'll issue a series of galleys. And these are actually printed. They're not digital. They're printed, and they're bound. They're not a, it's not an actual printed portion of our book. We'll actually send these to, you know, Publishers Weekly, to New York Times, Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, Miami Herald, fill in the blank. And you know, this will generate some buzz. This will generate the reviews that we're looking for. And if it's a good product, the product will speak for itself. If it's not, then it won't. In these games with buying 100,000 copies of your own book, you know, creating your own success, that's really felonious, you know, fraudulent. I mean, the proof is in the pudding, and that's with the critics and the reviewers, and that's who we have to deal with. It is what it is.
Yeah, I've noticed that you've done stuff a little differently. You've actually have like some clips, like almost, it looks like a movie trailer before you release your book.
So we do book trailers, and, you know, a lot of people, can you talk to them and say, hey, check out the book trailer, you know, for the book. And they're like, well, a trailer for a book? I've never heard of anything. Well, actually, it's quite popular.
Yeah.
It's, matter of fact, so popular that in New York every year they have awards for book trailers.
Wow.
So you can actually get a, you know, a movie award for having a book trailer, and, you know, so yeah, all of my books have book trailers. The book trailer for Battle of Angels, my fourth book, has actually been completed. We haven't released it yet, but it's, you know, at the risk of sounding like Donald Trump, it's freaking awesome. You know, it's amazing. It's the best book trailer of any of my books thus far. I love it. It's awesome. I'm psyched. I'm really psyched about this project. It's going to be a project that's going to touch people, which is my goal. You know, yeah, it's great to entertain people, you know, but listen, as an author, people will forget. Sometimes they'll forget the characters. They'll usually forget the localities. They almost always forget the storyline, but they never forget the way you made them feel. And that's my goal as an author. It's my goal as a screenwriter and a producer in the film business. I want people to feel, and that's my goal. And if I can't do that, you know, I failed at my job. That's not a good thing, to not make people feel. You know, to have someone walk out of your movie and be numb and, you know, not take anything away from it, or not wake up the next morning thinking about the message that you transmitted. I mean, that's what I'm trying to do here. And
knowing that,
so,
and having that in mind, how has your writing technique changed throughout the years of you know, different book to book?
You know, in the beginning, I was more focused on the sentence. Today, I'm more focused on the story. You know, it's funny because my first editor was a I guess, a former English teacher and did all these, blah, 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 this resume and stuff. And, you know, he was all about the grammar, and you can't do that in a novel. A novel is not about grammar. The best novels have the worst grammar. We have one-word sentences, you know. We have run-on sentences. We have short, choppy sentences. The bottom line is that if the reader reads your paragraph and they sit back and think about it, you did your job. Or you transmitted the thought. You transmitted the scene. Because writing a novel is just like writing a screenplay. You're writing scenes. There are scenes. And you have to create that scene. You have to develop that scene. And then you have to blend it all in together. So, you know, when you're writing a novel, you're always telling. You're always telling that story. So focus on the story, not the sentence. And, you know, remember that every word has a purpose, and every word can have amazing impact. The power of the word is incredible.
Yeah, I agree. And knowing that, how you write, do you think that transferred over into how you write for film?
Yeah, well, you know, with a novel, I have the luxury of being able to ramble. When I say ramble, I mean I can go into detail, and, you know, I can really stretch my point. You know, with a script, especially today, whereas before we kind of had a 120-page ceiling, now studios are kind of looking for 90-page screenplays. You know, the power of the word is, you know, that individual word is more powerful than ever. You know, less is more. So we're trying to get our point across with a lot less, description. And, you know, I'm constantly inundated with people, friends of other, you know, film people and so forth that want a little help with a script. And you know, you look at it and, you know, today's screenwriters are trying to be so many different things. They're not trying to be a screenwriter. They're trying to be a set designer because they design this immaculate set on their script for you. Or they're trying to be a costume designer. They're designing, you know, what their characters are wearing. None of this stuff belongs to the script. It's not about the story. The script is the story, and it's the dialogue, and it's telling the story with the dialogue. And you know, a little bit of action, and all this other stuff is, you know, has no place in it.
Is it harder to write a book and be more detailed than it is to write a script?
Yeah, I mean, a book is a luxury. A script is work because, you know, the first thing I do is I'll go ahead and I'll run a draft, and my drafts usually come out at 130 to 150 pages, and then start, you know, scalping from there. And it's hard. You know, it's very hard because you're passionate about this project. There are things you want to include. And that's not to say that 150-page version won't end up as a, you know, on a backlot someplace as reference. But when we're in the development process, that script's got to be trimmed down to size. And, you know, especially if you're working with a studio and you have studio readers and, you know, you have executive finance committees that are thumbing through your script. You know, the only person that I've ever worked with and I've ever seen get away with bulky, overwritten scripts is Aaron Sorkin. And he gets away with it, and he's a good fighter. And I think in another life he might have been an attorney. He can fight his case, and he wins. I don't have that. Pleasure, that ability. My scripts have to speak for themselves. I'm usually not there to defend them. So, you know, they've got to be right when they go out the door.
And you've been around film for a long time. You started at the age of 20, being involved.
Yeah. Actually, I was first introduced to film at 9. I grew up in Key Largo, in the Florida Keys. And I guess I was about 9 years old. I discovered, like, 2 canals over from where we lived, there was a dolphin pen, and they were training dolphins. And I would go over when the trainers weren't there. And would just, you know, had like a little box. I would sit with my feet in the water, and it was just an amazing experience. Well, I got caught by one of the guys. Turns out he was my dad was a doctor there, and he, in the Keys, and he was a patient of my dad's. And so he kind of, you know, let me do some feedings with them and all this other kind of stuff. And it was kind of an amazing experience. Well, come to find out, the dolphins are being trained for a movie being shot 100 miles away in the Bahamas called Day of the Dolphin, George C. Scott. Wow. So that was my first experience, you know, in the film industry. And, you know, that was the seed that eventually grew. So my first film I ever did as a Marine coordinator was Spring Break in 1983. I was exactly 20 years old, yeah. And then from there, got picked up with Miami Vice and did Miami Vice for 104 episodes, almost to the end. Wow. I took took 10 years off, and I worked for the government, did some other things. In 2000, I did back in and did Lost in Translation with the Coppolas and someone that I had met in 1999, a young Scarlett Johansson. And now I'm on my sixth film with Scarlett, the Ghost in the Shell for Disney and DreamWorks. So it's all been an evolution, you know. It's all about growth. It's all about continual growth. And, you know, I'll be growing 10 years now. So, you know, it is what it is.
What has been the most challenging aspect of the film industry? Because you've had several roles where you've been everything from writing down to producing to a little bit of everything. What's been some of the most challenging kind of endeavors that you've jumped into when it comes to film?
Well, the film business is like no other. The way you get paid is differently. The way you work is differently. It's feast to famine. It's, you know, working 16-hour days to going months without working at all. It, you know, it defies all of the work principles that people are taught that you're supposed to expect from a job. It's completely different. You know, I think one of the more frustrating aspects from a producer standpoint is dealing with, I call it the fringe of Hollywood, which is these people that are connected, but they're not really connected. You know, they may have an address in Hollywood, but, you know, are they really in Hollywood? You know, they're, you know, these sharks, if you will. I mean, they're out there, they're trying to, play these frauds, these manipulations. These guys are a dime a dozen, you know. 9 out of every 10 people that you deal with in this business are, you know, have malicious intent. They're not gonna produce anything productive for the project. And in the end, you're gonna end up paying them money for nothing. And so that's been hard road to travel down and to deal with these types of entities. But, you know, I can say that I'm at a point now where, you know, I think I'm wiser. I've definitely learned. I've developed a sixth sense for the, you know, these guys will, they'll send an email or I'll get a phone call or what have you. And, you know, after the first couple paragraphs of their spiel, you usually pick up what they're after. And, you know, you really have to be selective in the vetting process. It's due diligence vetting. And that's the way it is. You know, listen, if you're doing studio project after project after project, then you have to deal with that. That's not me. You know, I deal with a lot of independent projects. I deal with a lot of experimental projects. I'm not a formulistic guy. I try to create my own formulas. But, because of that, we have to deal with a lot of people who aren't necessarily mainstream. And that has its downfalls.
Yeah, and you jump into not only film on the big screen, but also in television. You've done a couple things in television, and even writing for TV has to be a little different because you're doing some writing for the Bill Maher show, correct?
Yeah, I did Bill Maher for 2 years, and that was completely different because that had to utilize a lot of my training. I do have legal training. I do have 2 other graduate degrees, and so you know, with Bill Maher, we're dealing with healthcare policy, we're dealing with immigration policy, we're dealing with legal issues that are very complex, and we're trying to break these down so that the average guy can understand where progressive policy is coming from, or why a particular policy is dangerous for the general public. And so this is completely different than character arcs and official story and, you know, storylines and those types of things. And that's challenging. I thoroughly enjoy it. I currently write for Huffington Post as a contributor. And so the political side is always intriguing to me, especially now with all the things that are happening. I'm a huge, huge supporter of single payer. And therefore, I'm a supporter of Bernie Sanders. He's the only one who, in my opinion, has the guts to stand up and say that we need to be looking at a single-payer healthcare system.
Yeah.
I'm very, very moved by the political process, yes.
What's your thoughts on Trump?
Say again?
What's your thoughts on Trump?
I try not to have thoughts about that.
Yeah.
He's not a serious candidate. He's not. I think it's a portrait of a segment of our country, and I think it says a lot about that segment. And I get it. Listen, people are frustrated. People are tired of the nonsense and the things that have happened over the last 20 years. To take it out on people simply because of their religious beliefs or color of their skin or they're here, regardless of their immigration status, whatever. I mean, it's real easy to be a bully. It's really, really cowardice to be a bully. But to stand up for a bully and to do what's right, that's what takes guts, and I don't see that with him.
Yeah, I'm really praying that he doesn't get any more traction on what he's doing, and he just kind of lays off.
I'm afraid that he probably is, and it is what it is. I think in all honesty, at the end of the day, no one is seriously going to vote for him for president. Certainly not, 51% of our electorate. So from that standpoint, let him win. That way we can beat him, on the progressive side. And I'm seriously hoping that Bernie Sanders gets the nomination, because I think he'll do a great job as president. Even if he can do, 10% of what he's trying to do, that's 10% in the right direction. So.
Well, you seem
pretty much what Obama's done. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you seem very well rounded in all aspects, and knowing that even at a young age, you got involved in film, and then your success in writing books, authors, and then jumping into the film industry, and then having this background I guess you were in. I don't want to say military, but you had, what was it, police, or you were involved
in? U.S. Customs.
U.S. Customs.
Yeah, U.S. Customs. So, it was actually at the time, it was the United States Treasury Department. So this was all prior to 9/11. After 9/11, the Treasury Department enforcement branches were broken up and were absorbed by the new Department of Homeland Security. When I was involved with Customs, the Treasury Department, and this was part of the Joint Drug Task Force, Blue Lightning Drug Task Force, and there were a dozen different task forces that were all converging on South Florida and dealing with the Caribbean, drug influx and their distribution paradigm to the rest of the country. So, the epicenter at that time, the epicenter was Miami. Now, a lot of that has changed and moved further west, dealing with the Mexican cartels and that whole scenario. But, in the 80s and 90s, it was Miami.
Wow. And would you say that's been a strong influence in your writing as well?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that there's a thread of, there's a character, a federal agent, Joel Kenyon, who's in all of my books. I write him in, and he is a primary character in Mid-Ocean, but I've written him into every book that I've done. And with good reason. You know, that's, he's a strong character, and, I want to make sure that I write more about him, this fictional character, this federal agent that doesn't always do the right thing, but he thinks it's right at the time, and it doesn't work out, he fixes it. So, it's based on a lot of fact, a lot of years of watching people make mistakes. The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Is he the character that you can relate most to as you?
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's all my characters are what we call composites. So we have, a character who may have six or seven different personality traits of six or seven different people that, I'm trying to incorporate into that character. So to say that Joel Kenyon's name would be incorrect. Does he have characteristics that I saw myself? Most definitely. And they're usually the flawed ones. He's usually a guy that is awkward. Listen, I grew up, grew up with Asperger's, live with Asperger's today. Asperger's is a form of, I think you in an earlier conversation called it mental illness. It's not a mental illness. Some of the people that have Asperger's, Steven Spielberg, Aaron Sorkin, just to name a few, at this point in my life, Asperger's is a benefit. I mean, Asperger's gives me the creative abilities that I don't think I would have otherwise. Am I a different person? Just as different as Larry David, who hosted Saturday Night Live this last week. He's got Asperger's, to say that it's a deficit is definitely not a deficit. To say it makes me different, 1,000%. And I got to tell you, man, I'll take different any day of the week. I love people who are different.
Yeah.
Difference what makes the world go around.
And
my characters have to be different,
Yeah.
We in the film business, we look for different. We look for unique. We look for people that stand out. And that's what makes that's the flavor of the world. That's the flavor of humanity.
Amen.
Would
you say, because I've heard it say that it kind of like helps you hyper focus on certain things. Is that
what it does is a hyper focus, and it's a generalized depreciation of focus. So, it goes from one extreme to the other. I can focus, extremely well, for short periods of time and devote an above average amount of attention to very small particular scenarios. For example, if I'm trying to depict a scene, I can enter that world. I can leave this world and enter that world and imagine what's happening in that particular scenario. The problems that I have are with general focus. So, I always had problems with school, although I spent a lot of time in school. It was very hard for me. It did not come easily. And so generalized focus, especially with issues that were tedious, you have to understand it, that this is wide spectrum autism. So, you know, when you're dealing with someone who has autism, think about some of the challenges that they are dealing with. They're usually revolved around learning disabilities. And so while, you know, I was able to complete a lot of my coursework and was somewhat successful at undergrad and graduate degrees, you know, it didn't come without painful, arduous hours of trying to figure things out and you know, pulling my hair out at times. I mean, it is what it is. A lot of people that I know that are very successful, I mean, you look at Steve Jobs, you know, Asperger's. Look at Bill Gates, Asperger's. But then for every one of them, there are a lot that didn't make it. There are a lot that, you know, that failed, that took out their frustrations with drug abuse and alcohol abuse. And so it's, you know, it's definitely a a two-edged sword, you know, without a doubt.
What would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions of Asperger's?
The biggest misconception is that it is a mental illness. It's not a mental illness. It's not, you know, in DSM-5, it's not even considered in DSM-5 at all. So, you know, it's not a mental illness. It's not treated as a mental illness, other than to say that some people do medicate. After all, there's other drugs. You know, at 52 years old, I've never taken a psychotropic drug, and I've done just well. So, I think that a lot of these psychotropics tend to numb the brain. They tend to evaporate some of the benefits that we're experiencing from these things. And so that's my point. Listen, if I have to live with this, I might as well enjoy the benefits. The benefits are that, you know, I can be incredibly creative. I can use my mind to create scenarios and stories and characters and projects that you know, I would be able to accomplish without this. So you know, to medicate that and to numb that ability just doesn't make any sense to me.
It's like a superpower, in a sense.
Okay, sure.
We'll take it as that. And also, I read that you have an uncle that that's also in the business as well, right?
Yeah, Michael Cimino, you may have seen his work, The Deer Hunter, mm-hmm. Heaven's Gate, phenomenal film, got very, very bad box office reviews back in the day, but today is considered a work of art, one of the best films ever made. And then he wrote The Rose. He directed Thunderbolt and Lightfoot with Clint Eastwood, one of Clint Eastwood's first movies.
Wow.
He wrote Magnum Force, which was one of the first Dirty Harry movies.
Yeah,
it's kind of cool. And it was kind of interesting. We lost a gentleman we call Vilmos. He's a cinematographer. He did a film in Bulgaria with me, Black Dahlia, in 2007, end of 2006, beginning of 2007. And Vilmos also worked with my uncle. He did The Deer Hunter and he did The Rose. So it was kind of cool to have, when he was with us and he was 82 years old. So it was kind of cool to have him there and connect those generations. And to hear some of the stories. I mean, he talked about my uncle very fondly. And my uncle and I are not planning on doing anything together. We probably never will. He is somewhat retired, spending most of his time in Paris and enjoying life.
Would you say at all that he was maybe like a mentor in what you were doing when you first started out?
No, not at all. I wish I could say that, but that wasn't the case. And I can honestly say that our storytelling, two very, very dynamically different styles, without a doubt. I've read everything that he's done. And he's actually done two books as well. He's written two books. But, we're night and day when it comes to film style, to writing style, script style.
Did you ever have a mentor when it came to the business? Is there anybody that kind of showed you the ropes?
I've had a few. Aaron Sorkin, without a doubt. Tommy Schlamme, our showrunner for Studio 60 on Sunset Strip. I got to tell you, I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for Scarlett Johansson. I owe her more than I'll ever be able to repay, without a doubt. She's been a tremendous influence, not just in my work, but in my life. Doing a movie with her in Bulgaria, I met my present wife and the love of my life, by working in Bulgaria. So, great things begat great things. And so I work with great people and all this, rubs off. It really does. Getting back to mentors, Shani Gabel, my writing style, she's currently my writing partner. We do occasional projects together. Shani is probably the greatest writer, screenwriter that I know. She wrote and directed La Song for Bobby Long, the second project that I was attached to involving Scarlett. Shani's an amazing writer, and I hope that I hope we see more from her in the future. She definitely is an asset to mankind and the creativity and the pure genius that she brings to the script is unparalleled.
Tell me a little more about your relationship with Scarlett. I know you said that that she's helped out a lot and she's been there since the beginning.
I met Scarlett when she was 15 years old. We were at a wedding, the same wedding. Shani was there as well. At that point in time, Scarlett was just starting to become noticed. She had done three or four movies. I think she was in the middle of the, there was, like, for the life of me, I can't think of the name of it, but it involves taking SATs or something. And then the bright red hair. At any rate. From that, so many things happened. It's funny, that wedding changed so many people's lives and was so positive. John Waits played at that wedding, and Scarlett later would release an album called Anywhere I Lay My Head. It's based on his work. He wrote the songs, and she released those songs with her own spin, and a very interesting album. Over the years, and it's not just Scarlett. Scarlett's mother has been a great influence and friend, and Melanie Sloan, tremendous person, a lover to death, Scarlett's people. She's surrounded by great people and quality people, people with character, and Tabitha Thorsted, or her personal beautician and hair person, amazing friend of mine and an amazing person, Heidi Moneymaker, who is Scarlett's stunt double, another friend of mine and a good person that brings with her just an amazing amount of character and work ethic and her performance. And many others, we could be here all night talking about great people that are attracted by other great people.
Now, how would you say that since then? I know you've been involved in film for a long time. How has the film business changed? Because I know now anybody can just grab one of these the SLR cameras and kind of just go at it and start putting movies out, and the switch from film to digital, and there's just been so many changes in film. What are some of the things that you've experienced that have kind of changed the game?
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there, and it's kind of like the writing. You ask me about the writing, it's the same thing has happened to film. The internet, the digital age has definitely increased access. That's not necessarily a good thing. Before you had this vetting process that keep the bad out, and pretty much what you saw was on a certain level. There was a bar there that people had to meet, and today that's not the case. Now, from an experimental independent stage, yeah, there's a lot of cool stuff that's happened. A friend of mine, Dara Wine, and his wife, a tremendous actress named Zoe Lister Jones, for $15,000 made probably one of the best movies of 2010, a film called Breaking Upward. Yes, they were the exception. They were able to enter into the fray. They were picked up by IFC and Independent Film Channel, and the rest is history. I mean, he's done very well. He's done an episode now of Mozart in the Jungle, nominated for a Grammy, or, yeah, for an Emmy, I'm sorry. And Zoe Lister-Jones is, NBC doing New Girl and many other sitcoms. There are, say, that 1 in 100, but there's so many others that just, it's muddying the waters. From a cinematographer / DP standpoint, it's a lot easier to create that atmosphere. We've got LED lighting that does all this and that and creates moods, and we've got filters out the ass, and we've got software that can change this and do that and enter this, and but listen, at the end of the day, people are going to watch your movie not because of the cool filters or because of the set or because of the lighting. They're going to watch the actors. And if the actors suck, the movie's going to suck.
Right.
So at the end of the day, the actors not only have to be good at acting, but the script, the words that they say, have to be good as well. So, that transcends just the simplicity of just grabbing a DSLR camera and going out to start pointing and shooting. It's all about composition, and that's what they teach you in photography class. It's about composition. Anyway, you can take a picture of the wall, but it's what's in that picture. It's that matters. In a film, it's what people are saying. It's how they're saying. It's inflection. It's the craft of acting, and that's not so easily replicated. You certainly can't replicate it with a DSLR camera.
Yeah, that's true. What would you say have been the best piece of advice that you've received from anybody in the industry?
Wow. It's just gonna be, I know it sounds cliche, but when you find, and I say because this doesn't happen on Michael, you have to find your own course, your own craft, your own ability, and that's discovering what you're really good at, and knowing that, this is a style, this is, be it your writing style or your script style, once you develop that, stick to it. Don't be swayed by adverse criticism. Don't be swayed by situations, because this business can change in a heartbeat. And that goes both ways. But, you know, listen, you know, you might be ready to throw it all away and go sell shoes or go sell cars or go do something other than the film business. But, you know, that that green light is right around the corner. And you know, you just got to stick to it. And it's hard. It's the hardest thing that most people will ever do. And it washes out most. In this business, most people that wash out because of that. Little did they know that, you know, probably right around the corner there was something waiting for them. And they quit just a little too soon.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I've seen plenty of that here. Now, what? How can people get in touch with you or find out more about you? If maybe somebody has a question, or you know, maybe you can give some advice on a personal level or anything. Is there a way that people can reach out to you?
Yeah, yeah, they can go to my website. It's trcimino.com. That's trcimino.com. I'm on Twitter, and that's T Raphael, and that's RaphaelCimino. And, you know, that's on Twitter. I'm supposed to do 3 tweets a day. I try to make them brilliant. They're not always brilliant. Sometimes they're actually stupid. But I do 3 a day. So definitely follow me on Twitter and find out what stupid thing I'm going to say. It'll probably be really stupid. I promise you that. There's at least one that's stupid a day.
Now, is this something
I guarantee that
your publicist is asking you to do, or is this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's all part of the big paradigm. You know, we've got to do three tweets a day, and they've got to be tied into the whole Facebook thing. Listen, if you want, you know, probably the best thing is through Facebook. When I've got time that I can actually devote to helping and trying to, you know, do these things, I'm on Facebook. If I'm not on Facebook, I'm usually working, doing something else. But if I'm on Facebook, so if they look me up, I think I'm listed as Todd Raphael Cimino on Facebook. Hit me up. I'll be, you know, if I'm available and I've got the time, which I try to make time, because I believe this is very, very important. You know, I believe we're put on Earth not just to help ourselves, but to help everyone else. And you know, if I've got the time, believe me, I'm there for someone who is willing to invest their own time, without a doubt.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate you getting back to me and reaching out, just even having this conversation. It's a blessing, and it's an honor to learn so much from a man that's been doing it for so long. And it's, you know, it's a beautiful thing. So I really appreciate you reaching out and helping out and you know, having this conversation, because I think a lot of people can learn from your experience, and your story should be told. So thank you.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you, Ruben, and it's an honor to be one of the first few guests on your show, and I wish you all the world of success, and I think you're going to do just great, man. And I'd love to come back on if you'll have me, in a couple of years or something. Okay.
Anytime. As soon as the new projects come out, let's get on and let's promote them. Let's do that.
Sounds good, brother. Well, I appreciate you having me on, man, and thank you very much.
I appreciate it. And there you have it. You've just been connected, okay, and we will talk soon. Thank you. We are out. Connected.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.